Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mansoor Farhang, professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont, who assesses the difficulties facing the Bush administration as it attempts to pacify and restructure post-war Iraq. Philip Agee, former Central Intelligence Officer, currently residing in Havana, who gives his perspective on the recent arrests of 75 dissidents and the execution of three hijackers in Cuba. And Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union President John Wilhelm, who addresses the labor movement's opposition to the Bush administration's targeting of immigrants, a growing proportion of the U.S. workforce. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Argentina is headed for a May 18th runoff election, where former president and free marketeer Carlos Saul Menem will face off against center-left candidate Néstor Kirchner. Meanwhile, global investors are looking for a new agreement to reorganize the country's debt and open doors to free trade and weaken laws protecting labor. The conflicting goals of combating deepening poverty and satisfying global capital markets will put a huge squeeze on any new Argentine government. In the days prior to the presidential election, police fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and charged protesters outside the Bruckman clothing factory that was taken over by workers after the 2001 Argentine economic meltdown. There were reports that dozens of demonstrators were arrested. In response, the protesters accused the police of brutality. After the factory's owner walked out and abandoned the building, garment workers stayed over the last year and a half and continued to make clothing, mostly expensive suits. The workers had been evicted twice before, but later won in court. According to the BBC, Buenos Aires police raided the Bruckman factory to enforce an eviction order and remove 57 workers who are locked in a legal battle with the factory's owner. The garment workers had become symbols of resistance in the current economic crisis in Argentina. South Africa in recent years has been internationally recognized as the rape capital of the world. Sexual assault is so widespread and convictions so low that the government instituted a special rape court to hear cases. As a result, conviction rates in sexual assault cases has skyrocketed and the government is now expanding the number of rape courts. 3 years ago, according to the Christian Science Monitor, 8% of South Africa's reported rapes ended in conviction. Some 70% of the victims in the cases are children. But now, in the special courts, the conviction rate is upwards of 80 to 90% for the rape cases brought. Magistrate Motadzi Nemahidi, a judge for 18 years, explained, "You have to exercise a lot of patience because most of the time you're dealing with children and women who have been traumatized." Some defense lawyers have challenged the rape courts for providing too much emphasis on victims' rights. Yet the South African Constitutional Court has upheld the powers of these new courts. Founded in the early 1990s, the Forest Stewardship Council offered a green seal of approval for timber practices that incorporated guidelines for biodiversity and protection of native peoples and worker rights. The FSC has an impressive record of success in certifying woodlands in 25 countries covering over 60 million acres of forests. The council, supported by major environmental advocates, forestry interests, and indigenous groups, has gotten the attention of major timber companies such as J.D. Irving, the Canadian firm that owns a big share of Maine's vast woodlands. In particular, Irving wants the Green Seal to sell its wood products at Home Depot, the giant chain of hardware and lumber stores. Yet some eco-activists, reports E, the environmental magazine, feel that FSC has been too easy on big timber companies and been used to escape tough regulation of clear-cutting. Activists cite the case of Mendocino Redwoods Company in California, where the company faced a lawsuit seeking disclosure of its clear-cutting plans from the Redwood Coast Watershed Alliance. Instead of disclosure, the company made a secret deal with FSC to have its forest certified as green. Maine activist Mitch Lansky, who runs the Low Impact Forestry Project, pulled out of the FSC certification after Irving was giving a glowing review for its operations in Maine's Allegash Wilderness Area. Lansky wondered, "It's not clear what FSC is certifying, practices or promises." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau. We'll be right back.
As the Bush administration works to pacify and restructure post-war Iraq, continuing violence and power struggles between various factions are creating an unstable and dangerous situation. In the latest in a series of confrontations between the U.S. military and Iraqi civilians opposed to American occupation, U.S. troops shot and killed 15 civilians and wounded 75 demonstrators who were protesting the soldiers' presence in the town of Fallujah. Despite the U.S. Central Command's effort to prevent Iraqis from celebrating the 66th birthday of ousted leader Saddam Hussein, a number of commemorations did take place, especially around the former leader's hometown of Tikrit. Retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner, the man appointed by the Bush administration to rule post-war Iraq, organized an April 28th closed-door meeting of hand-picked Iraqi citizens and exiles to begin the formation of a U.S.-backed transitional government. But this heavily guarded assembly drew the ire of several thousand Shiite protesters who claimed that the meeting did not represent the interests of the Shiite religion, practiced by 60% of Iraq's population. Concerned about the growing political strength of Shiite clerics in Iraq, the White House warned the government of neighboring Iran, also a majority Shiite nation, not to interfere in Iraq's internal affairs. News that the Bush administration was considering the selection of former CIA Director James Woolsey as an advisor to any new U.S.-appointed Iraqi Minister of Information and the inclusion of the former chief executive of Shell Oil Company on an American-created council to oversee Iraq's oil industry has done little to quell suspicion of America's motives in the country. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mansour Farhang, professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont, a native of Iran who assesses the religious and political difficulties facing the Bush administration as it attempts to install a new government in Baghdad.
Iraq was like a prison for 30 years. It was really an incredibly vicious machinery of repression. And people who have gotten rid of this thing, we don't really know exactly about their political tendencies, their preferences, their reflections, what kind of an impact this experience has had on them. So in the short run, the most radical and the most vocal, the most passionate elements could appear to have dominated this scene. But I doubt very much if they really represent the sentiments and preferences of the Iraqi people. So we have to wait and see. But with respect to exiles do not have a popular base in Iraq. But if there is a consensus, if there is a collective attempt to move toward an inclusive, pluralistic system, definitely the exiles could be very important, not so much as political leaders, but as managers, as technocrats.
But is the United States and the Bush administration making a mistake by putting these exiles at the head of the line, so to speak, for control and positions of importance in this interim government that they're now putting together?
Absolutely. If the United States does this, it means this claim of wanting to promote democracy is a complete deception, that it's impossible to take Mr. Chalabi or others like him, however they might be competent technocrats or businessmen and all that, but they will have no relationship with the Iraqi people. And it would be impossible to create a legitimate political order by appointing these people who have been associated close to the CIA and the State Department, which means this strategy means everything the Bush administration is saying about democracy is a complete deception. There is no sincerity in making an effort. But the first step toward really identifying a movement toward democracy is the extent to which people and their representatives are involved in the political process, and that remains to be seen yet.
What can you tell us about the various power movements within the Shiite clerics that are now involved in the struggle for power, and what, if any, are their connections with Iran's government, as the Bush administration charges and warns against their interference in the affairs of post-war Iraq?
Ayatollah Hakim and his brother, they have lived in Iran since 1980. They're very close to the Iranian government, and they also have an armed force of about 10,000 armed men, militias trained and equipped by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. They're still in Iran, and the Hakim definitely is interested in taking these forces to Iraq. He even suggested to the American commander that they wanted to help them to take over Basra, and the United States rejected their help. This is one group. Now, exactly how influential the Iranians are with respect to duplicating the project of the Iranian revolution remains to be seen. But there are many other clerics who do not want an Islamic Republic, who think religion should play a role, but not in this of creating a theocracy. There are conservative elements such as Ayatollah Sistani, who is the most senior and perhaps has the largest following in Iraq. He even doesn't want the clerics to get involved in politics. There are other some clerical elements who are very close to the United States. Ayatollah Khoui, the man who was assassinated in Iraq a couple of weeks ago, he was very close to the CIA, but he represents a group of people based in London. The most radical elements are the ones who say we want to establish an Islamic Republic of Iraq. And Iran is in a very difficult and tenuous position. Helping this particular wing of the Shi'i movement is very dangerous because the United States could, you know, retaliate. On the other hand, it is, you know, it's a kind of an ideological crisis for them if they stand on the sideline and watch them. But my guess is that they calculate their political interests, and after what has happened to Iraq and after the pressure on Iran with respect to the nuclear issue, Iranians will do nothing. They might engage in propaganda, but will do nothing in terms of material assistance or arms shipments across the border to help anybody, because helping any one group in Iraq means instigating civil war in Iraq. It's, in my opinion, it's unthinkable for Iraq to have a regime like the one in Iran. It's impossible for any one group in Iraq to dominate the entire country. That's why I think I'm somewhat optimistic that Iraqis, if they are genuinely interested in creating order and stability in their society, movement toward democracy becomes a necessity. This is the only way they can live together. Otherwise, it will be a bloody and unending conflict.
Well, what do you make of the United States' rejection of any United Nations involvement in overseeing the organization of an interim government? It seems that all over the Middle East, many people and governments are suspect of the motives of the United States' invasion of Iraq, and the fact that the UN is not being allowed in as some kind of neutral referee to put together such an interim government. Does that not fuel these suspicions?
Definitely, definitely. It's a very negative. That makes me very skeptical about the American claim of promoting, you know, democracy, because if the United States wants to impose a client state, a new form of dictatorship, perhaps not as cruel as Saddam Hussein, but dictatorship in the sense that there is no open political competition and participation in the country, that's why they don't want the UN. But if the United States is interested in actually promoting democracy, then the UN can play a fantastic role of legitimizing the process. The Iraqis who work with the UN, if the UN was involved in assisting the process of conciliation, consensus building, and constitution building, and so forth, the Iraqis associating with the UN would have gained legitimacy. That's why I feel very skeptical that the United States is really not interested in democracy, and imposition means doing it alone, and they don't need any international observer.
That was Mansour Farhang, professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont. Read Farhang's March 17th Nation Magazine article, The Triangle of Realpolitik, online at www.thenation.com. The speedy trial and sentencing of dissidents, as well as the swift execution of three hijackers in Cuba, has been condemned by the U.S., charging Cuban President Fidel Castro with gross human rights violations. However, Cuba's Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque stated that the Cuban government has not charged these individuals with just criticizing Cuba's leadership, but that they conspired with James Kaysen, the head of the U.S. interest section in Havana, in blatant organized subversion. Kaysen has unabashedly been organizing dissidents in high-profile and provocative meetings, reportedly even in his own home, in gross violation of diplomatic norms. Cuba asserts that these so-called dissidents were receiving money from the U.S. government and had total access to the U.S. interest section. Oswaldo Paya, principal architect of the Varela Project, and Elizardo Sanchez are two well-known dissidents who were not arrested in Cuba. Some claim it's because they are not known to receive U.S. dollars as those 75 who were recently arrested. Millions of dollars have been funneled by Washington through USAID and other groups to help organize opposition in Cuba. Seven acts of terrorist hijackings have taken place in the past 7 months as a result of the Cuban Adjustment Act, a U.S. law which provides asylum to all Cubans who can make their way to the U.S. Philip Agee is a former Central Intelligence Agency officer who served in Latin America during the early 1960s and later resigned. He spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari from Havana, where he now lives, and provides his perspective on recent events in Cuba.
The 75 people were receiving money from Miami, from Puerto Rico, from Spain, in the many thousands of dollars. And they were using that money to create what would amount to an opposition civil society here in Cuba. Cuba, as it happens, has a very flourishing civil society in terms of voluntary organizations and NGOs and so forth. There are more than 3,000 of them here operating every day in Cuba. But the purpose of this money was to go to people who would create a political opposition in Cuba, calling themselves a civil society. And any government in the world, I think, would not allow that to happen, paid by a government which is declared to be your enemy and who is declared to seek your overthrow. That, in a nutshell, is what happened. And I was surprised, and in fact, when I learned the facts about what these people were doing, and a lot came out because there are about 12 Cuban infiltrators, that is, people working for Cuban intelligence and security, who were working in top positions in these organizations inside Cuba. And they were handling the money, for example. They were handling correspondence. And they knew what everybody was getting in terms of the money. And these people were getting thousands of dollars, saving it. One person was found to have, I think it was $8,000 hidden away in a suit, and he had not worked in 10 years. So these things are all adding up to a very unfortunate situation, and the executions were extreme measures taken to send a signal, I believe, to everybody else who might be thinking about that. Well, as we speak, Denise, Fidel is speaking on television. He's been going on now for over 2.5 hours. The first hour was dedicated to a very detailed chronology of the outrages that this fellow James Kaysen, the head of the intersection, has been carrying out since he got here last September. And I was pretty shocked because I served in 3 U.S. embassies in Latin America, and I never heard of any diplomatic officer or diplomat going out to the opposition like this man has gone and encouraging them to make trouble for the government. We'd worked secretly with some of these people, but Kaysen has been doing it all completely openly and in the most provocative form possible. The second hour of Fidel's talk tonight on television has been dedicated to the cases of the 75 so-called dissidents, but mostly to the executions of the 3 hijackers who tried to take the little Bay Ferry over to Florida. And he was giving the reasons why. These include the fact that during April alone, the Cuban Interior Ministry has investigated 29 more cases of attempted hijackings, just like these ones that have already happened. And Fidel also announced that from now on, the Cubans will not give any fuel to any aircraft or boat that is hijacked. This, in essence, is what he's doing, and I think he's doing this probably because he realizes, and everyone else does too, that Cuba has gotten a very bad press on this. In fact, I don't think they handle it too well from the point of view of public relations, because they should have published something equivalent to a white paper that is going case by case, all 75 people, saying what they were doing, what they had written, or what they had promoted, how much money they were getting, where that money was coming from, and eventually, of course, back to the U.S. Treasury Department, showing that this was the reason why they were prosecuted and convicted under what is equivalent in Cuba to our sedition laws in the United States.
So, in other words, these 75 so-called dissidents were not actually arrested for expressing themselves, criticizing the Cuban government. What actually are the charges against them?
They were charged under 2 laws. One was the law of 1998, which the Cubans call the Antidote to the Helms-Burton Act. And this is a law that criminalizes anyone who serves the purposes of the Helms-Burton law in terms of subversion in Cuba. The other law goes way back to the 60s and actually was based on a criminal code of Spain in the 19th century when Cuba was still a colony of Spain. But essentially, the laws were to serve a foreign power and be paid for it. And that's exactly what these people were doing.
That was Philip Agee, former CIA officer, author, and dissident, who had his U.S. passport revoked in 1979 by the State Department, speaking from Havana. Coinciding with the trend of increasing numbers of immigrants working in America's service industries, a rising proportion of members of the International Union of Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees are recent arrivals to the United States. At its 1999 annual conference, the AFL-CIO appointed a special committee on immigration chaired by John Wilhelm, the president of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union. The committee made several proposals that represented a major sea change in longstanding AFL-CIO policy. Among the legislative changes recommended were amnesty for millions of undocumented workers, replacement of employer sanctions, and restoration of safety net benefits for immigrants abolished by 1996 federal legislation. Since September 11th, the labor movement has become increasingly vocal in its opposition to the Bush administration's targeting of immigrants in the war against terrorism. Wilhelm was the keynote speaker at an April 26th conference on the USA Patriot Act and other threats to civil liberties held at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. His talk focused on the need for immigrant workers in the U.S. labor force and the importance of defending immigrants' rights as a bulwark against the further erosion of civil liberties of all Americans.
In times of perceived crisis in our nation's history, there have always been not only pressures on the civil liberties, which are so important to our nation, but beyond just pressures on those civil liberties, horrific violations of them. And the list is long, but we must also acknowledge, I think, that movements and organizations that so many of us devote tremendous time to and believe in have also been guilty in those times of perceived crisis of giving in to pressures against civil liberties. The labor movement, in which I've spent most of my adult life, has given in periodically to those pressures, most notably to its own detriment as well as the detriment of the nation during the McCarthy period, when the labor movement accepted the loyalty oath and destroyed those unions which didn't accept it. And in doing that, I believe, sapped the militancy and the energy of the labor movement for the next 40 years. We have of course, a long national pattern of violations of civil liberties in times like these, the Palmer raids, the horrific internment of Japanese Americans, McCarthyism, and so on. And wrapped up in that history is a long history in times like these of confusing immigration issues with national security issues. A brigadier general in the United States Army testified to a congressional committee in 1942 that, after all, a Jap is a Jap. And that was, of course, part of the rationale for that internment. Now, many years later, our president apologized for that. And we often do that, but only much later. Before 9/11, we had tremendous momentum in this country to reform our immigration laws and to try to make our immigration laws somewhat more consistent with the reality in our country. We all came here from someplace. It's part of the history of this country, but we also are very ahistorical in this country. We have a tendency to forget that fundamental central fact about the history of our country. We have more immigrants in this country today than at any time in our history by a considerable margin. And the dispersion of immigrants amongst the total population has changed rather significantly. It is not possible to grow the American economy without continued substantial immigration. The native-born population of this country, and particularly the native-born workforce of this country, will actually shrink over the next three decades. So you literally can't grow this economy without continued substantial immigration. But of course, we have this tremendous hypocrisy in our immigration law. Our economy requires immigrants in order to continue to function. And so we say, come on, some of you can come legally, but most of you can't, so come anyway, because we need you to do this work. And increasingly, immigrants are not just in the so-called undesirable jobs, like the ones that our union represents in hotels and restaurants across North America. Increasingly, immigrants are in every industry, in every occupation. Immigrants are in every part of our economy, and they're absolutely vital, and we need them, and we want them, and we invite them. But when they get here, we say, but most of you are going to be, at best, second-class members of our country. And in particular, we're not going to give you any rights, even though we need your labor. And in particular, if you try to organize a union, or if you try to take advantage of the laws against discrimination, we're going to draw a line there. So that's the legal framework that these immigrants who we invite to this country and who we need to make our economy function exist in. Before 9/11, we were making tremendous progress toward fixing those laws, and all of us know that post-9/11, there's been a horrific backlash in terms of immigration law reform and in terms of the rights of immigrants. We, of course, have short memories in this country. We immediately forgot that the last previous significant act of terrorism on American soil was in Oklahoma City. Most of the horrific precedent that gets set is pioneered against immigrants, and particularly non-citizen immigrants. And once the government has established both the legal right and the political acceptability of very repressive measures against illegal immigrants, they then tend to move to immigrants who are legal and then to American citizens.
That was an excerpt from a speech by Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union President John Wilhelm at an April 26th Civil Liberties Conference at Quinnipiac University. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus. For more information, contact HERE at area code 202-393-4373 or visit the union's website at www.hereunion.org/immigration. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.